Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Hi there. We have Ron Friedman with us today. He's a psychologist. He's a writer. He's taught in universities. He's appeared on NPR. He has written most recently, The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. He is both artist and scientist. He's smart about the way he thinks about things and he bases it on research. We're lucky enough to have him with us today to talk about his new book, The Best Place to Work. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of books on the workplace talking about how to create a best place to work. I'm wondering why you wrote this one.
Well, you know, it really stemmed from my personal experiences. So I spent years as a college professor teaching at universities and doing research in the lab about human motivation. And then I decided, you know what, being a professor is great. But the reason I got into it is because I like learning new things. And as a teacher, I didn't feel like I was learning very much. I was kind of repeating what I knew to a new group of students every semester. So I decided I was going to go off into the corporate world and study and just experience that for myself. And so I became a pollster. So my job was to measure public opinion and figure out what people think and how do you change those opinions. And really loved that job. But in the course of being in the corporate world, what I came to realize was something that was really surprising to me, and that is that there's a massive divide between what psychologists know and how most organizations actually run. And it's really everything from the way that companies hire to the way that managers motivate to the basic layout and design of the modern office. And it's not for a lack of effort. You know, every business owner that I've worked with is interested in building a great workplace, but the challenge is that they don't have time to read academic journal articles. So I wrote a book called The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace that takes over 1,000 academic studies, really tries to curate them, distill them down, and make them actionable for everyone, whether they're a leader, whether they're a CEO, whether they're just someone who's entering the workplace for the first time.
There is a wealth of research in this book. I think you have over 1,000 studies. And it is someone has to do that, right? Someone has to make it applicable. So I appreciate you having done that.
Thanks. And you know, I have to tell you, it's not something that I decided I was going to go off on this grand journey and go on this Herculean effort of writing this book. It was really just information that I was aware of as a professor I kind of took it for granted that everybody understood it. See, when you're surrounded by people who are experts in the same little area of the world that you're an expert in, you just kind of take it for granted. You assume this is obvious to everyone. And so it was really an eye-opening experience in seeing all of the information that's available to people that they're just not putting to use.
So what's the big idea of this book?
Well, you know, I think it kind of goes against the grain in the sense that there's not just one big idea. So every chapter in the book is about a different area of the workplace and all of the information that we've amassed over the last few decades in that area. So there's a chapter on design, there's a chapter on hiring, there's a chapter on providing feedback. And I guess if I was to sum it all up and say this is the one big idea, I suppose I would say that there's a lot of research showing that what people ultimately want at work is to have the same experiences that they have in every other domain in life that they are seeking, and that's to have psychologically fulfilling experiences, meaning that we all have the same basic human psychological needs, and when we have those needs fulfilled, we tend to be happier, healthier, more productive. So what are those three basic needs? Number one is the need for competence, so feeling like you're good at what you do, but also feeling like you're growing your competence on a regular basis. Number two is feeling like you're connected to the people around you. So feeling like you're valued, you're respected, you're acknowledged. Having that those close human relationships is a basic human need. And then the third one is the experience of autonomy. So feeling like we have choice in the way we go about doing our work. And when we have experiences that fulfill our basic human psychological needs, we're happier, healthier, and more productive. And there are ways for us to experience those needs in a variety of different ways. So there's the experience that we have with our manager, the experience that we have with our colleagues, but also the way that our basic, you know, the office design, the way that does our office support our need for competence or does it undermine it? And so the book talks about all of that through the lens of psychological needs.
That's really useful to have some kind of a theoretical template that people can begin to think about and say, huh, if I'm going to have this conversation, am I increasing their autonomy or decreasing it? Am I helping them to be more connected or less connected? Am I giving them the feeling of competence or less?
And, you know, a great example of that is something that managers think that they're doing that's helpful, that's actually undermining people's experiences, and that is the Employee of the Month Award. And so the Employee of the Month Award is a really well-intentioned idea, the notion that we're going to single out one person and say, you've done a really great job here, and we want to recognize that. But what ends up happening in a lot of workplace settings is that you end up taking one person, and let's say you have 100 people in your company, you take one person, you recognize them, and then there are 99 people who go off feeling like this month's efforts weren't recognized. And it also creates this competitive setting between employees. So now recognition is a limited resource. So if you do a great job, I'm less likely to recognize you because it takes away from me. And also, you know, it's tied to a timeline. So a lot of times you'll have a person winning it and feeling like, man, did I do a good job this month, or did management just need to fill a role? So a much better approach is to create a culture where recognition doesn't just come from managers. It comes from the people around you. So creating that, modeling that behavior in meetings, for example, if you're a leader, starting off by every meeting by thinking about someone who's done something specific that's really helped move the mission forward, and recognizing that person. And if you model that behavior, that action of recognizing someone at the beginning of every meeting, you're going to see that spread throughout your organization.
Can you recognize people too much?
I think it needs to be authentic. So I think if people feel like you're going through your template of how do I run a meeting, then you got to recognize somebody. I think you got to find something that's specific and that really is worthy of recognizing. And I think that there is that assumption that people have that if I provide too much, if I constantly acknowledge people, if I recognize people too much, then it's going to lose its value. And I think that what that misses is the acknowledgement that we have that basic psychological need for competence. So if we're not getting any feedback for extended periods of time, that is demotivating, and a lot of times it can really damage your engagement on the job. So, you know, a lot of companies rely on annual reviews to give people feedback. And that feedback is just not coming at a frequent enough ratio and a frequent enough basis for people to feel like they're engaged on the job. So I talk in the book about the psychology of video games and how that relates to how we can create a better workplace, a better work environment. And one of the things that video games do is they provide very frequent feedback. And that experience becomes addicting for us because we like to feel like we're growing and we have feedback on knowing how to correct our behaviors. And when we don't get frequent enough feedback, we just lose interest and we start thinking about where's my next job coming from? Where am I going on my next vacation? So you really do want to create an environment where people don't necessarily feel like they're being heaped praise all the time, but they're getting enough information in order to improve because that feeds their need for competence.
Makes a lot of sense. What is another couple of things, either things we do that get in our own way that you have replacement behaviors for, or low-hanging fruit, things that people could do immediately? They're listening to this. You know, here's two or three things they could do immediately that's going to improve their productivity and effectiveness.
Well, if you think about creating an engaging work environment from the perspective of how do we fulfill people's psychological needs, we could take that. Take each of those psychological needs one at a time and identify some things that anyone can do to improve the experiences that they're creating. So, for example, the need for competence. How do you create experiences that fulfill people's psychological need for competence? And, you know, the idea is you want to have people feeling like they're growing on the job, but that's really time consuming. You know, as a manager, you're busy taking conference calls, you're traveling to meetings, you don't have time to worry about whether Brenda in accounting is feeling sufficiently challenged every day. So one tip I offer in the book is creating a reading budget. The idea of empowering people in your organization once a quarter or once a month to go off to the bookstore and pick out a book that is in some way relevant to their job. And it's a little bit of an investment. What it does is it creates opportunities for people to learn new ideas and new information, be exposed to new information that can then improve their performance and create that feeling of growth on a regular basis. If you don't have that budget of allowing people to get a book, you can encourage them to scan industry blogs during the workday. That sends a signal that learning is something that we value in this organization. It's not something you're expected to do on the weekend or on your early morning commute.
Yeah, you're talking about two different kinds of budgets. One's a financial budget and the other one's a time budget. And they're both, people are short on both often, and you seem to need both of them.
That's a great point. That time budget, that's a wonderful way of thinking about it. We create these environments where we require people or expect them to monitor their emails all the time. And that's depleting. That is when you have to constantly make the choice of, am I going to respond to this now or am I not? That can be depleting, and that undermines people's experience of competence. On the point of the psychological need for relationships, an easy thing you can do is when you introduce somebody into your organization, don't just talk about their professional bio and their professional experiences, but spend a little time interviewing them to find out what they like to do in the evenings and on the weekends, and introduce them by their professional experiences, but also their personal interests outside of work. That creates opportunities for people to find commonalities that they can then bond over. So if you like to bake chocolate chip cookies on the weekend, and I like to bake chocolate chip cookies on the weekend, that there's a chance that we're going to click, but we need to know that about one another in order for those relationships to be formed.
You know, it does something even more than that, I think. I love the idea. And it's, if you could find out what someone does in their spare time and you can get them to begin to do it organizationally, you don't have to manage them anymore. They're going to be self-motivated because this is what they love to do. So if you could find someone who, I remember was working with someone once who showed me her dating spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. She was an assistant of an executive. And she had, down the left column, it was all the people she dated, which was impressive in and of itself. And then on the top, it was all these different criteria. And I said to her, what about love? What about, that inexplicable feeling you get when this one eats soup with a fork, and the other ones all ate with a fork, and you thought they were idiots, and this one you think is really awesome. And she said, "Oh, no problem. I have a column for that. I weighed it 20%." And I immediately got my client to take her off of being his assistant and have her manage our project, because she had all of the skills that she loved doing these spreadsheets. And so, if you can find out what someone does in their spare time and get them to do it organizationally, you're already kind of relying on or leveraging their competence and their autonomy probably in a way that's really useful.
I think that's a really interesting insight. And, when it comes to these relationships, we often take them for granted at work. We say, we're going to provide you with the training, we're going to buy you a nice computer, we're going to give you an office, and we assume that that's enough. But in fact, having those close friendships at work really contributes to our performance, and also leads us to be more loyal to our company. Once upon a time, you used to have there's such a thing as loyalty in the corporate world, where you join a company and you can expect to be there for 20 or 30 years. That is no longer the case. It's become easier than ever to change jobs. And when that loyalty to a company doesn't exist anymore, we still have loyalty to friends. We still have our loyalty to our colleagues. And I can tell you from personal experience that I've had experiences where I've stayed at a job for too long, where I knew that I wasn't learning anything anymore and I wasn't being sufficiently challenged, but I didn't want to let down the people I worked with. And so having that as a motivator is something that is really, really compelling and can lead people to work harder, because it's one thing to let down your boss, but it's a completely another thing to let down your friends.
So one question that I'd love to ask is this idea of having great friends at work, and the fact that you stayed in this job longer than you would have because you had those relationships. And I wonder if that's good or bad for the organization. Meaning,
because I'm no longer as engaged as I could be.
Yeah, because you're maybe there for the wrong reasons. Meaning the right reasons would be because you're sort of super engaged in the work and that you want to achieve things for the organization and you're going for outcomes, versus, I'm loyal and I just don't want to leave, but I imagine that your level of engagement drops, a bunch of points. And is that in effect, a negative?
Well, I think that your general point is well taken about you don't want people who are coasting. But in my case, and I think in a lot of similar cases where people are there because they feel connected to the people on their team, that level of interest in the job is not necessarily going to have as great of an impact on people's performance because, again, they're tied to the people around them. So the motivation comes not from the paycheck or from the organization, but the motivation comes from working on a team. And I think that's a more sustainable level of motivation. So there's research I talk about in the book that shows that when we're working with people who we like, who we're close with, we tend to be more focused because we can pay less attention to whether or not we're fitting in. We can pay more attention to actually doing our job. We're more open with our feedback. So if, for example, Peter, you and I are working on the same team and we're close, I can take you aside and say, hey, Peter, you know, usually you get this stuff 100% right, but here I think you may be off on the wrong path. So now I'm more honest with my dialogue than I would have been if we were strangers. And I'm also more willing to ask for help when I need it because it's not going to reflect poorly on my relationship with you because we already have that basis of trust. So when it comes to close friendships, I think it's perhaps the most overlooked element to creating a great workplace is ensuring that people feel connected to one another. Too often we leave it to chance, and it's perhaps one of the best predictors of whether or not we stay and how engaged we are on a day-to-day basis.
That makes a lot of sense. Let me change track a little bit and ask you a couple of things that I wondered as I read the book. One is, do we really need to be happy at work?
It's an interesting question, and here's what the data shows is people who are happy at work tend to work harder, they're more productive, they can be more creative. When we're in a good mood, we're much better at connecting different ideas, we can think more flexibly. And so there are a lot of benefits that come from being happy at work. Now, that said, I will admit to you that I have seen the pendulum swing a little bit too far to the side of let's make everyone happy. Happiness isn't going to contribute to stronger performance on every task. It's going to contribute to better performance on some activities. So, like, for example, I mentioned creativity. So if you're having a brainstorming session, for example, putting the people in the room in a good mood at the beginning of the brainstorm will probably lead to better ideas than if they're feeling stressed out. That doesn't mean, however, that happiness is going to elevate our performance on every task. So if we're tasked with trying to root out mistakes or find typos, being in a good mood might make us careless. So I think you're right in the point that you're suggesting here, which is that that happiness isn't going to be necessarily beneficial in every domain at work, but overall, you're a happier employer is going to be a more productive employee. And so you should aim towards providing them with experiences that make them more satisfied on a day-to-day basis.
Where is there room then for the kind of conflict and discomfort that feels like is really necessary to come up with the best work product or the strongest leadership?
Well, I think that you do need to have that expectation that not every day is going to be a picnic. If you're growing on the job, there's going to be periods of time when there's struggle. That's okay. You're not supposed to, you're not supposed to come into work and be euphoric all the time. But from a managerial perspective, aiming for a happy and engaged work environment is going to yield dividends for you as opposed to the alternative, which is just allowing people to feel frustrated all the time.
Yeah. And I imagine also some people are happy with some discomfort. And I'll use myself as an example. I like pushing myself. And in pushing myself, I'm going to be uncomfortable. That's the only way to sort of expand my capacity. So I recognize that that's a part of it. Would that also sort of translate into happiness?
I think it can because it yields experiences of growth. And so that's when you're growing is when you are struggling and then you're stretching yourself and you're using that feedback to improve your performance in the future. Those experiences do contribute to engagement. So again, the point I'm making here is not that we need to have people happy all the time. However, we should consider when we design our workplaces, where we think about the workplace experiences that we're creating, that happy employees tend to be more productive and more creative. And so there are times when you want to create those experiences because that's going to benefit the product that you're working toward.
So people are really different from each other, right? What's best for you, I imagine, because we're talking about the best workplace, but what's best for you might be worse for me. And I don't know if that's true or not. It's my question. Is there really such a thing as a best place to work?
Well, I think that there are, the idea of the best place to work is not this is there's just one best place to work and here it is, but rather here are all of these research insights that you can apply to your organization to create an environment that engages people and meets its potential. So in other words, how do you improve the organization that you have and make it the best possible workplace it can be? To your point that there are personality differences and temperamental differences that we need to take into account, I think you can create an organization that leverages those differences. So here's what I mean is we talked about the need for autonomy. One of the ways that you can make people feel more autonomous is by providing them with more control over their calendar. So allowing people to work during the hours that they are most effective rather than requiring them to sit at the office between the hours of 9 and 5. So some people are morning people, other people are night owls. And when you provide people with the opportunity to say, you know, you kind of figure out what hours work best for you to the extent that's possible. It's not going to be possible for every organization and not necessarily every day, perhaps only some days. But what it does is it allows someone like me, for example, I'm a morning person. I will work between the hours of 9 and 12, and then maybe I'll take a lunch and then not work until 5 o'clock because I know that I'm going to be much stronger between 5 and 8 again, rather than sitting comatose in front of a computer because it's not yet 5 o'clock. That's an example of a way that you can allow people to customize their roles to their personal temperamental strengths that then leads to better performance.
So let me ask a question about that because I know, for example, a CEO who loves that idea, right? Who will read the research and say people need flex hours so that they're working most effectively. And that's their need. But his need is to have people in the office. He has a need, first of all, to see them there and to know that they're there, but also so that when he or other people need something, they can go over to the person and they're sitting there. And maybe one of the things that the reason the person likes their flex hours is because they're going to be undisturbed and they can get a bunch of work done. But maybe the reason that other people want them in the office is because they need them to you know, talk with or get approvals for, things like that. So how do you balance that, and whose needs do you go with? You know, what makes the CEO happy or the leader happy or the manager happy or what makes the employee happy? Or how do you navigate the complexity of that?
Well, I think that what I would recommend is looking at what's going to make people more productive and more engaged and using that as the criteria for how we make decisions. So if we're using a personal preference at the expense of what makes people more productive, then I think that that's not a very useful approach. And that's not to say that we should ignore what the CEO is looking for. So what I would encourage that particular CEO to try is to experiment one day a week, for example, with allowing people to choose their own hours, or perhaps to say, okay, we're all going to be at the office between 10 and 2, but the rest of the hours are up for you to decide how to use. And you know, we often take this black and white approach of we either do it this way or we do it that way, and there's nothing in between. And that's where the experimentation is valuable. Try out some new things, maybe for a period of a week or a month, and then survey your employees, look at some hard metrics, determine what is working best. I think we get locked into thinking that the way we are currently doing things is the best way of doing things. And I don't think that that's a wise approach. I think we should continuously strive to improve. And that doesn't just apply to ourselves personally, but also to the way we run our organizations.
I mean, there's two things you've said here that I really love. And one is to really identify the outcome that you're going for and then assess based on that outcome, because ultimately, mm-hmm. you know, we're in business, we're leading, we're moving organizations forward to achieve some kind of outcome. So to identify what that outcome is really clearly, and then to assess is the behavior helping or hurting. And the other piece is experimentation, like to really, right. you know, not take anything. It's kind of the difference between research here and me-search, right? You know, the sense of like what works for me in relation to this, given who I am and how do I shift things around?
Yeah, you know, we started off by talking about my experience in being in the corporate world. And this is one of the things that was really demotivating to me working for other people is in a number of cases, I would work for employers who required that I be at the office at certain hours. And it was completely demotivating because I knew that I could be more productive working from home. So that's not the case for everybody. Some people work from home, feel like they could be they're distracted. But I found the office environment to be very distracting. I found the constant emails, the constant phone calls, all of that was very distracting to me. So I think it ultimately costed the relationship. Is they ended up losing me. I wasn't in the organization anymore because of the fact that I wasn't able to have that autonomy where I knew that the bottom line is the important thing was to get things done. And having that requirement of FaceTime was undermining for me. And I think that a lot of people have that experience. And I think that if you are a CEO or a manager or a leader who has the opportunity to give people more autonomy, at the very least, try it out and see if it works before assuming that people are going to go home and watch Netflix. You know, I think there's a lot of people assume that's what's happening. If the people go home, they're just going to go and goof off. But the reality is, you know, we have a cell phone now where we can goof off all day. And I think that's what ends up happening is people, you end up having people at the office between the hours of 3 and 5 when they're exhausted. But what are they doing? They're on Twitter or they're on Facebook or they're ordering things for their family on Amazon.
Right. And some workplaces block certain kinds of websites to prevent people from doing that when they're in the workplace.
Now they can use their phone. So, yeah, like, what's that doing?
Right. People will always find a workaround if you're trying to impose some kind of control they want to resist.
Absolutely. And wouldn't it be, don't you think that we would have more energized, more engaged organizations if we said to people, we're going to measure your performance, we're going to evaluate your performance on outcomes, not on the way you do your job, but rather on whether or not you're achieving the objectives we've hired you to do. We're going to treat you like an adult. That's why you're here. And if the work isn't getting done, then we're going to find a more suitable approach. But rather than having people, really kind of monitoring like their children. Like these are the things we need you to sit at your desk between 9 and 5. We need you to do the following activities. That is not a recipe for engagement.
That's great. And I guess they know about this stuff now, assuming that they read your book, because you have all of this information in the book. And so then their challenge might be to close that gap between what they know and what they do. But you arm them in The Best Place to Work with a lot of great data-based, research-based insights about, you know, what we know works and what we've seen doesn't work.
Yeah, and every chapter ends with an action item, with a series of action items that are both for people who are in leadership positions or are emerging leaders who are going to be leaders in the future, about things that you can do to apply the information to the way that you do your work.
Ron, thank you so much for spending the time with me and with us. Thank you so much for writing The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. It is an extraordinary book. Thank you for writing it. Ron, aside from being one of the nicest people that I know, you actually have really great insights that you share, and I really appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you, Peter. It's an honor, and I can note that I'm a big fan of your writing, and I'm sure the podcast is going to be a huge success.
Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.